I've been confronted with my own truth here, and more than once I had to put down the book and think about why do I feel uncomfortable in the way he's putting the story.
Welcome to our season called Book Talks. In the first two episodes, we will cover the book Stuffed and Starved, the hidden battle for our world's food system. The author, Rajiv, or Raj Patel, is a British Indian academic, journalist, and activist. He holds a PhD in development sociology from Cornell University. In this book, he focuses a lot on the inequality of our food system. The main thesis of the book is that there are more people who are overweight than people who are starving, and that solving the issues in our food system is not just about increasing yield, and it's much more a poverty and distribution issue. I'm joined by my amazing co-host Frank Kühne in this season, and he's the managing partner of the Adalbert Raps Foundation, which offers grants for scientific research in food technology. But more on that later. Let's jump right in. Red to Green is the most in-depth podcast on food sustainability. And in this season 7, we discuss key takeaways from books on the food system. I'm your host, Marina Schmidt, and I'm joined by my co-host, Frank Kühne. So I think the way that Raj Patel describes it is he looks at it historically. He also breaks it down based on who is to blame, or not even who is to blame, but what are the issues in the current system, and then therefore, like, who has the most responsibility to fix it. So one of his central themes is, of course, multinationals, and the liberalization of the market caused a lot of issues. The first thesis is our food system is an hourglass shaped food system, and that is an issue. So he has this overview where he shows Netherlands, Germany, France, UK, Austria, and Belgium, and what their food supply chain looks like if you look at how many players are in each step of the supply chain. And then it's over 3 million farmers and producers, and it becomes smaller and smaller, less suppliers, even less manufacturers, only 8,000 manufacturers. The overview from the book is actually from data ranging from 2000 to 2007. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the actual numbers. It's more about the principle and just having that in mind, that we have a lot of farmers at the top of the hourglass shape. Then it becomes thin when we look at the middle stage of the supply chain. So that means manufacturers and retailers especially. And then as it keeps going, it broadens again when we look at the actual consumer base, where it becomes the widest.
And then there are only 110 buying desks. I actually double checked like what that exactly means. So
yeah, what is it?
You were wondering?
Yeah, I was wondering too. I never heard the term, and I've been working in the food industry for the last 20 years. So what is a buying desk in Europe? Tell me,
Exactly. He also didn't explain that. The retailers, they give the power to agencies who are responsible for purchasing. So there are 110 buying desks or agencies that make decisions about what to purchase.
But I think he simplifies too much. And from all my experience, I never actually talked to a buying desk. I always been negotiating directly with the retailers. So you are invited to come to their administration office, the purchasing office, and you have tough negotiations with them about the product you want to sell to them or the product they want to buy from you. And I think what he means is, and I'm actually not quite sure if that is true. I would differentiate between unprocessed agriculture products like vegetables or plants that we eat. And then there's packed food and there's processed food and there's frozen food and so on. So I think perhaps, and that might be true, agricultural products are bought by a buying desk, but the majority of products are bought directly from a retailer. They have the purchasing power. Why should they go direct via a buying desk?
I think this hourglass shape is very catchy, even if you take out the buying desks, right? You remove them. Okay, let's remove the buying desk. Where the thin part of the hourglass is, where the sand kernel of sustainability has to press itself through, is the supermarkets, the retailers, because there are only 600 retailer chains. And connected, you know, to the book, the carbon footprint of everything, we were discussing, oh, we know air fried is super bad.
getting your food from heated greenhouses is horrible for the environment. But the consumer cannot have a decision that is balanced because it's not on the label. It's not on the label. If the retailers would say, we can just decide we are not going to buy and sell foods that have such a high CO2 emission that's unnecessary, then that wouldn't be even an issue. But of course, then you rely on the retailer's sustainability goals. And also what I think he's pointing at is the entire system, the liberal market system, just incentivizes everybody to just go for profit as the only bottom line.
I think in the book, the hourglass example is like one of these things where I can say there is some truth in it. And I think he's right when he says, what is the purpose of the food system? The purpose of the food system is not to feed us, but we do it for profit. He blames the industry and the traders and the politicians for setting up a rigged game.
And yeah, because actually his thesis is the market liberalization and the building of multinationals was argued based on we need this to make it cheaper for the consumers. He argues that that isn't actually always the case. So
there's a very interesting explanation of NAFTA. So I will quote him again here to give you a bit of the viewpoint of Arash Patel. The North American Free Trade Agreement, an economic union between Mexico and the United States and Canada, was the mother of all free trade agreements. And it was the first to mesh two rich countries with a significantly poorer one. For the majority of poor farmers, NAFTA hit hard. The price at which US farmers sold their corn was much lower than the cost to produce it. In 2002, for instance, US corn cost about $1.70 per bushel to buy, but $2.60 for US farmers to produce. And this is because of subsidies for machinery, fertilizer, credit, and transport that the US is giving. And quoting Raj Patel, when the price of corn fell, one would have thought the price of tortilla would have also dropped, but it didn't. It actually saw a price rise as NAFTA began. January 1994, the average price for a kilo of tortillas was around 50 pesos. By the end of the century, the price was 7 times higher. But why is that the case? And Raj argues, in the tortilla market, the number of food processors is very small indeed. Two, the players GIMSA and MINSA actually sound like cheeky siblings, you know, like the... Together, they control 97% of the industrial corn flour market. Remember, this is a bit of an old book, so maybe the specific numbers aren't as up to date. He summarizes, the market, through competition, is supposed to bring increased efficiency and lower prices. But the effect of turning food production over to the market has been to produce less competition and offer more structural power to the largest companies. During the demonstrations regarding NAFTA, it was announced that the subsidy for every head of EU cattle was more per day than the income of 3 Mexican farmers. I just found that quite startling how intense the subsidies are if you also compare them on a global scale.
So I thought about this as like a dual expansion of power. The larger you are as a multinational, the more power you have, just like Amazon does it, right? To increase your prices at some point, and then also to push down the prices on the supplier side. And the thing that I do like about his focus is that he talks a lot about what it means for farmers and how this system is becoming increasingly unstable, because there used to be a time where if you have a local market, you can sort of rely on there being a need for a certain kind of food product. But nowadays, like a farmer who's growing soy or wheat, the question of what kind of price he will be able to get for his crop is so impossible to predict, because a war in Ukraine and increasing subsidies in the US all have an impact on the local farmer.
I think that there were so many things you just said I would like to come back. What I learned again is I'm not a politician. I'm not an institutional scientist understanding the rules and laws of how institution reacts. Like, I'm really missing some background information.
Here it makes sense to do a little detour and actually explain, who is Frank? Frank has two main positions, one of them being the chief of advisory board at Raps GmbH. It's a natural ingredients company in the south of Germany, and they're processing herbs and spices. But probably most of his time goes into working for the Adalbert Raps Foundation, which funds applied scientific research. For example, they also work with startups and they fund academic research related to ultra proteins.
I started to work for the foundation 8 years ago. Basically, I'm the managing director or the managing partner of the foundation.
And to clarify how this is related, Raps, the spice company, is actually funding the foundation.
It's a very interesting story. We never actually talked about that over the last 4 decades. Roughly 25% of the profit of the family business goes into the foundation and then is spent by the foundation, controlled by the Bavarian government, back into the society for any kind of projects.
It's a really great example of a company that is donating a lot back to society. You can find out more about the foundation by Googling the Adalbert Raps Foundation. You can also follow the link in the show notes. Possibly you or somebody you know could actually apply for a research grant there. And with that, we can go back into discussing Raj Patel's criticism, how price develops along the supply chain.
So it's more my experience out of the industry and working in the industry and reading some books on these topics. From what I've understood is that is a rigged game as well, because it's not freedom of the market. We are blocking out African farmers from the European market, and at the same time, we allow European products to flow freely into the African market, and by that, disturbing the whole local market. That's something which is, out of my perspective, not freedom of the market. That's already been manipulated in a way. There's a flaw in the system again. But that doesn't mean the liberalization of the market is wrong.
So I think the main one is also that the US, UK, Japan, and Germany, like all the industrialized nations, actually did something different. We have loads of subsidies for our farmers and lots of support for our farmers. And at the same time, these contracts disallow it in the global south.
So Raj Patel mentions that in the end of the 1970s, the World Bank was one of the few organizations that had both the means and the will to extend credit to governments in the global south. And that was all connected to many countries being close to bankruptcy and they needed money. So the bank made loans available, but it did so only if certain conditions were met. And those included a suite of changes in the economy. And the most important part is that domestic supports, the actual support system for farmers, was dismantled. So farmers did not have any guarantee market or minimum price for their goods. All of that would be dismantled.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what I was trying to say, that on that level, on trade level, where institutions and governments agree upon certain terms how they do trade, the system is not well balanced. There I can agree. And that's something where the focus should be on how to improve these systems. He actually proposed this kind of more complex farmer system where you have local farmers with a, I don't know how big a good farm is, yeah, but where he has a farm that is self-sustainable, delivering to a certain amount of people around him the food they can eat, they not want to eat, but it's what he has. Yeah, this system on the other level is under risk a lot more, because you have a drought, you have a storm, the yield is gone, there's no harvest. Then suddenly the whole local region is out of food. A more global food system is able to balance these kind of needs depending where it comes from. Don't worry, you have difficult rain season in Vietnam, you're lacking rice. We can balance that out because there's more rice being grown in, give me a country which is growing rice. Vietnam.
China.
And China. Let's call it. They basically do everything, yeah. So I am rather more pro scaling up farms than contra scaling up farms.
I agree with you that scale also means efficiency. So if people are in general against industrial large scale agriculture, I think there is also benefit, right, to every kind of problem that we have, we need a variety of solutions. We can benefit in the mix of solutions from regenerative agriculture to improve soil health, and we can also use community-supported agriculture, which leads to farmers actually having a good income. In the last episode of our food waste season, I actually talked to a farmer who is doing community-supported agriculture in New York, and she also diversifies her crops. So she is growing aubergines and tomatoes and zucchini and everything. And if one thing doesn't work out, then she still has several different crops to work with. And the people agree that, well, they will take whatever happens to be in season that year.
I agree. Like, so, standing on 1,000 foots is more stable than standing on 1 foot.
Yeah. Let's say the base issue is that retailers are pushing the prices for most farmers to a level that just doesn't even allow them to live off of their farming.
Yeah. Yeah. So the food system, from my point of view, evolves because it's profit-driven and scale-driven from small entities towards a bigger business, bigger farm system. And I was wondering if we would have a similar discussion when we're looking into the mobility industry and the change from horse-powered cars to real cars or combustion engine-powered cars. They disappeared. Like, I was wondering, of course, we're talking about food. If we're looking into the past, said, oh, it's such a great past, we need to keep the farmers up. Or if we need to let it go and said, there's a new development in town. Our food system is an industrialized food system. There is no space for small farmers. Let's make sure they transition to a different job, a different setup, than trying to keep them in a system which is not sustainable for them. Do you see what I mean? I'm not quite sure if we're holding on to a picture of the past here. Go back 150 years into the European or the German setup of the farmers, and then ask a family that was running a farm at that time if they would have wanted to keep on going, or if they wanted to be industrialized.
That isn't an issue that only affects small farmers, because he also describes how the liberalization in terms of NAFTA between the US market and the Mexican market led to huge maize producers having massive issues, because the maize from Mexico was competing with heavily subsidized corn and maize from the US. Yeah. And so the issue is, of course, are we going to revert liberalization of the market? No, I think it's just a matter of being aware of that. So in this case, we need to understand the system as it is, and it is not fair. There are subsidies, like, for example, there are subsidies in Germany for cows and milk production. I don't think
tons
there are that
and
many
tons,
subsidies
millions,
for
billions
oat.
And billions. Yeah.
And I was thinking today, like, is my oat milk subsidized? Why do I pay $2.50 for freaking oat milk?
It is. I'm pretty sure it is. But what I wanted
it is,
to,
but not as heavily, not as strongly.
What I wanted to point out, the only experience in the agriculture business I have is in herbs and farms. And I've been to big companies growing in huge volume pepper, and I've been to nutmeg farmers in India, where family businesses basically growing the nutmegs and harvesting the nutmegs. And if you talk to those families and if you talk to those farmers, they don't want to be a farmer. They want to move on. The biggest issue for us as a spice company or spice and seasoning company is, in regard of sustainability, roughly we're talking to 1.5 million farmers worldwide, growing pepper, curcuma, ginger, garlic, cinnamon, whatever, cloves, whatever you can think of. I'm not able, even if I want to have certain sustainable standards, I can't push them through the system to the farmers. I can't talk as a mid-sized company to 1.5 million farmers. It's a lot easier to set up a discussion about our sustainability goals with a bigger player like Olam, who's growing pepper in Vietnam. It's not a solution. It's just something I wanted to highlight, that I think there are disadvantages with this kind of local farmer, mid-size, sustainable. And we're not only talking about the farmers in the United States and in Europe. We're talking about farmers in Africa that have a small plot of land. They have two goats and they barely survive from what they grow. It's a very idealistic picture sometimes of the farmer being self-sustained.
You gave me an idea here. So what I find so fascinating, when we did the food waste season, if you look at the breakdowns, 2-3% of the food waste along the supply chain is caused by retailers. And like in France, they had the regulation that it's a necessity for retailers to, they are obliged to pass it on, but oftentimes they pass on yellow broccoli, like something that's already not eatable.
Okay, maybe this needs a little bit more explanation. So in France, it has become obligatory for grocery stores to donate their leftover food. And one issue that came up with that is that sometimes retailers would donate it way too late, so donate yellow broccoli. But the thing is that once it's donated, whether it's eaten or not, retailers can check it off their books. They don't need to account for the food waste if they have passed it on in some kind of fashion.
So to me, it's always the question, who has the power? Who has the ability to negotiate the strongest? Mm-hmm. Who has the ability to divert both risk and responsibility up and down the supply chain?
Yeah.
And in that case, like the way that you're describing this right now, let's say, of course, an ingredients company may not be in the best position to talk to the farmers at the beginning of the supply chain. So in this case, actually, the responsibility maybe also lies a step before that, one or two steps before that, with the local cooperatives. Like somewhere in this supply chain there is the point at which things can only be sold for 25 cents per kilo. And that pushes down all of the prices beforehand. And he was even arguing, even fair trade, it's a bit better, but it's not guaranteeing a good income for farmers.
Even us as a mid-sized company, it's not that easy to buy all the pepper as a fair trade quality.
But if you would want to improve the livelihood of farmers as an ingredients company, right? Yeah. Is there a way to do it?
Marina, that's a very challenging question. I'm very much driven by our responsibility in our supply chain in both direction, and it's quite challenging. And I'm going to give you an example. We had we were drafting a project in Cambodia where we were trying to work with about 100 farmers that were growing pepper, and the idea was basically they would have been able to supply us 7 to 8% of the pepper volume we're buying per year. And the basic idea is, guys, we can see that the fluctuating pepper price is an issue for all of us. It's an issue for you because sometimes it goes below your production cost, sometimes it's above your production cost. And our job is to supply. We are selling security in regard of price stability and product quality. And obviously, the farmers were very happy when we said, okay, we agree on a stable price. We know your production costs. We know you want to have a profit. And if you see the highest price and lowest price, we said, let's meet in the middle. That's a fair price for all of us. We can put that into the market, arguing that is a more sustainable, better price for all of us. And the cooperative, they basically said to us, oh, yeah, we're more than happy to sell our products for, let's say, I'm taking a number, 7 euros the kilogram. But if the price goes above the 7 euros, we're going to sell on the open market. So we weren't able to find a solution, an agreement where we had a kind of a security and they had security. But basically, they wanted to have a stable price as long as we were cutting their loss. But as soon as they would have made a higher profit, we would have been out of the game. And I know several examples of these kind of attitude of farmers. And I know we're not talking about the poor farm in India that has 2 trees and is hardly surviving. Even on the farmer's side, it's profit-driven. They grow food because they want to make a product out of it, which is absolutely okay. Yeah. But the system, there's, again, I think he oversimplified with some of his solutions. And you actually need to dig deeper and find a solution on the different levels of the food system. Yeah. And I think we should rather work for the farmers to enable them to transition in different fields, limiting the supply of the market, by that increasing the price for the products and being traded and have a more sustainable setup.
Though I don't think that even if you would industrialize everything to a point where you have these large scale farms, which have a little bit more leverage, still the difference, like if right now in Europe, it's like 3.2 million farmers to 8,600 manufacturers. And of course, different steps in between, right? That's still such a vast step. So I think farmers, by definition, it is a rather small scale, specialized business. And so there needs to be a certain setup of the system that just makes sure that they're doing better than on the completely open market. Nikhil, somebody from our team, told me like just a couple of years ago, the Indian government was thinking about changing the system. So they had these local markets organized by the government where the farmers could sell their produce for a fixed price. And then the Indian government was thinking, oh, maybe we just open it up so the farmers can work directly with the manufacturers and distributors. And the farmers revolted big time because they said, no, we don't want to deal with the big corporations. We are afraid that they, in the beginning, will give us better prices and then long term go back to pushing us down and exploiting us. But I think most of the time, who benefits from this system a lot is the corporation. Because if they want wheat, they can go to Ukraine, they can get it from Germany, they can source it from the US. So they have all of these different options. And if there's issue here or there's a cheaper price there, they don't take on any of the responsibility.
I think retailers or traders for agricultural products or industry companies can change a lot quicker than a farmer on the other side who is bound in his education, his land, the way he set up the land, the way he set up the plant, the machinery he has bought, the farm workers he trained. He's bound with a time lag to a certain system, to a certain product. And that's true. That brings him in a bad negotiation position.
Here's another quote from the book to add to this point. If you know that you're going to get low prices, you can plan. You can switch to grow something else, for example. Yet one of the greatest ironies in the shift towards markets and food is that by joining the world market, farmers have lost the very thing that justifies faith in the market's efficiency, price signals, aka having some kind of stability in terms of how much money you get for your products. I continue quoting, particularly in the global south, trade liberalization has rarely been accompanied by working mechanisms to redistribute its gains to the poor. Here again, we see Raj Patel has a very global perspective. He has a strong focus on the poor, which arguably is often left out too much, right? And he's very egalitarian in his arguments.
It points at the issue that we're just in general lacking transparency in the food system. For sure. And that's an issue that also multinationals have. And if they try to trace back where they have their products from. So we cannot come up with a solution to it right now. And that's also okay. We're just debating like what the system is and trying.
I think, yes, there is an unfairness, a disbalance in where the profit ends up and where not. And I rather criticized him in the way he was setting up the whole story in the book than denying there was an issue.
I think it would be really funny to have a call with him.
Oh, God. Rajay?
Raj.
Raj.
call him Rajay. Raj. Yeah, let's start with that.
Raj. So, Raj, if you hear that and you're already, you have your hands up in your head and say, oh, my God, they haven't understood a word. And what morons are they? Just give us a call. And more than happy to have a discussion. As you can see, we're quite funny and really enjoy controversial discussions. So, could be interesting.
We have opinions.
Yes, we have opinions.
If you know anyone who would appreciate talking about the meta topics in the food industry to ask the big and tough meta questions, it would help a lot if you just take 20 seconds to simply forward them a link to this episode. A big thank you to the entire team, especially Celeste Gupta and Radhika Ramachandran for audio editing. Until next time. Let's move the food industry from harmful to healthy, from polluting to sustainable, from red to green.